Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
I think there's about maybe a third of you are awake. That's good. I've met with various people in the church and talked to them. Last night, we went out to eat with John Rambler. We went to some kind of Brazilian restaurant. Fantastic. They give you these little cards, and the one side's green, the one side's red. When you flip it over and it's green, then they start bringing you these meats. They shave it right off for you. When you want them to stop, you turn it to red. The thing is, when I turned it on red, they just kept coming. And they said, would you like some of this? And you say, of course I would. So you eat it. I want to borrow one of those cards, maybe take it home with me. See if they'll sit on the couch and just flip it to green and see what happens. Probably not much will happen. Anyway, enjoy getting to know him. This Sunday school lesson today, I'd like to talk a little bit about the Old Testament. And before you fall asleep, let me say a few things about the Old Testament. I would like to give you the parable of the banana and the coconut. Now, this is directly stolen from my favorite scholar, who I call Dad. This is my father's analogy. Okay, this is the parable of the banana and the coconut. When you think about interpreting the scriptures, the New Testament has direct reference for us today, so it's a lot easier to understand. And in my analogy, the New Testament is like a banana. It doesn't take a lot of thought. You just peel it and eat it, and you have a great time. Fantastic. Quick meal. However, the Old Testament can be a little bit more tricky. So in my analogy, the Old Testament is a coconut. When you look at this coconut, you think, it's going to take me a while to get inside there. I'm not so sure. But let me tell you this. If you do the work, you get inside there, you'll be happy. It's very delicious inside. It's going to take some work. So today we're going to work on the coconut. This may take some work, and there will be pictures. This makes this easier. We're going to work on a coconut. Today, we're going to look at the Old Testament and understanding the culture. And a big part of the culture is the different gods of that day. The main god that they struggled with was the god Baal. The word Baal simply means Lord. But it was a pagan god. And if you read through the Old Testament, it just seems like they're doing the right thing, they're making the right decisions, they're obeying God's covenant, things are going well, and then they get off following this Baal character. Things go south quickly. They're devastated. Perhaps they're overrun by another pagan country, or the rain supply stops, but it's always this Baal, and you wonder, you ever wonder this, what is so attractive about Baal? Why are people just so interested in this guy? What's the pull for Baal? Where's the interest in this? It just seems obvious. After a while, you'd say, this isn't working out. Let's not go with Baal anymore. He's not really helping us. So what was the attraction with Baal in the Old Testament? Why were the people so tempted by him? What was so seductive about Baal? I think if you understand Baal, I think it'll help unlock a lot of the Old Testament. Okay, my first concept. In the Old Testament, there's certain concepts you have to get grasp. If you get your head around certain concepts, then a lot of things will open up. Let's get our first concept. Our first concept is water equals life. In the ancient Near East, no water, you're done, you're dead. You have to have water. They didn't have a municipality or whatever, you could just buy bottled water perhaps. You had to have water. Without water, famine, death. They knew this, water, life. Christ even plays on this a number of times. John 4:14. But whosoever drinketh the water that I shall give him shall never thirst, but the water that I shall give him shall be in him a well of water springing up into everlasting life. He's going to twist this to a spiritual application. The water I give you is not just make you survive, it will give you a spiritual life. So Christ will twist this analogy. Okay, water life. The question is, where do they get the water from? As you can see, Israel is located inside the Fertile Crescent. It's a land bridge between three continents. You have Europe, you have Asia, and then below them you're going to have the African continent. So this is kind of the bridge between that. This is why militarily there's so many problems, because everybody wants their two land bridges, the two roads, the Way of Kings, the Way of the Seas. And Solomon gets rich, he sets up a toll road, gets very rich off of this. But anyway, you see up in Mesopotamia, in the middle there, you have the Tigris and the Euphrates. So they They always have water. No problems there, right? These things run year-round. And then below them in Egypt, they have the Nile. So, if you're in the middle there, and you're Egypt, what source is your water? Where's your source of water? This is a little more tricky. Can I see the next slide? Well, you have the three sources of water. Sea of Galilee, and I think you have to click it again. The Dead Sea, and then in the middle you're going to have the Jordan River. This one seems simple enough. You click it one more time, I think. This is one of those multiple slides. I stole this from somebody else, and I really hate the multiple slides because it just confuses me. Okay, you got the three sources of water in the middle of Israel. So it seems simple enough. You'd have plenty of water. Unfortunately, the water table is fairly low, and it has a real chemical content to it. So this is not the kind of stuff that's going to really help you. You can't really drink this or water too much with this. So this source of water is not going to be sufficient to sustain survival. What do they have to rely on? They relied on small streams, tiny wells. Very, very rarely they had if you were very wealthy, you could have a cistern. A cistern is a hole in the ground. It would collect rainwater, and it would keep it clean. You were able to use it, but it was something of a rare commodity. This is the analogy Proverbs is going to use for fidelity in a marriage. It's like a cistern. It's very valuable and refreshing. So they have these small sources of water. So what's the big need for survival? Rainwater. The sources they have are very sparse. And sometimes they have, this is a result of rain, they'll have what's called a wadi. It's a seasonal waterway. In the Old Testament, it talks about the river of Egypt. It's actually a wadi. It's not actually the Nile. But a lot of their source of water was wadis, which was rain-related. Let me go through some Old Testament references that talk about this. The land would be very productive if they would depend on God and God could give them rain. Just to walk through the Old Testament, I'll read some verses here. Genesis 27, 38-39. And Esau said unto his father, "Hast thou but one blessing, my father?" This is when he was cheated out of the birthright. "Bless me even also, O my father." And Esau lifted up his voice and wept. And Isaac, his father, answered and said to him, "Behold, thy dwelling shall be with the fatness of the earth and the dew of the heaven from above." Here's the blessing. You'll have plenty of rain. Exodus 3:8. "And I am come down to deliver them out of the hand of Egypt and bring them up unto the land, a good land and a large, unto a land flowing with milk and honey, and the place of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, Hivites, Jebusites." Leviticus 26, "If you walk in my statutes and keep my commandments and do them, then I will give you rain in due season, and the land shall yield her increase, and the trees of the field shall yield their fruit." Verse 18, "And if ye will not yet for all this hearken unto me, then I will punish you seven times more for your sins, and I will break the pride of your power, and I will make your heavens as iron and your earth as brass." This is bad for growing crops. Joshua in Numbers 14:8, "If the Lord delight in us, he will bring us into this land and give it unto us, a land which floweth with milk and honey." Deuteronomy is the second giving of the law. The parents had already blown it, so we're going to have a second try with the children. Deuteronomy 6:3, "Hear therefore, O Israel, and observe to do it, that it may be well with thee, that ye may increase mightily, as the Lord God of the heavens hath promised thee, in the land that floweth with milk and honey." A quote from the book of Ruth and the book of Judges. Ruth is inside of Judges, okay? It's the same time period. Judges 21:25, "In those days there was no king in Israel, and every man did that which was right in his own eyes." So this is the time of great apostasy. And Ruth chapter 1, verse 1, "And it came to pass in those days, when the judges ruled, that there was a famine in the land. And certain men of the Bethlehem of Judah went to sojourn in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his sons." So, we have apostasy and we have drought. Jeremiah 3, verses 2 and 3, "Lift up thine eyes unto the high place and see where thou hast not been lain with. In the way hast thou sat for them, as the Arabians in the wilderness, and thou hast polluted the land with thy whoredoms and with thy wickedness. Therefore, the showers have been withheld, and there hath been no latter rain. And thou hadst a whore's forehead, now refuses to be ashamed. Okay, in case I haven't made my point yet, I have more scripture. Jeremiah 11:4-5, obey my voice and do them according to all which I commanded you. So shall you be my people, and I will hear your, I will be your God, that I may perform the oath which I have sworn unto your father, to give them a land flowing with milk and honey, as it is this day. Then answered I and said, so be it, O Lord. Okay, we have this desperate need for rain. If rain is survival, water is life, the question is, where does the rain come from? Who provides it? The obvious answer is, keeping God's covenant, God will provide for you. You obey God, He'll take care of you. He'll protect you, He'll provide rain, you can survive, things will be great. This is the simple answer. However, Israel, in their sin, turned away from this. 1 Kings 17:1. And Elijah the Tishbite, who was of the inhabitants of Gilead, said unto Ahab, as the Lord God of Israel liveth, before whom I stand, there shall not be dew nor rain these years, but according to my word. Chapter 18:17. And it came to pass, when Ahab saw Elijah, that Ahab said unto him, thou art he that troubleth Israel. Then he said, I have not troubled Israel, but thou and thy father's house, in that ye have forsaken the commandments of the Lord, and thou hast followed Balaam. So why was the rain withheld from Israel? Because they refused to follow God, and instead they fell into the idolatry of Balaam. So, question, do we keep the covenant or do we follow Baal? Let me tell you some things about Baal, why they'd have been so attracted by him. The word Baal, as I mentioned, is the word Lord. A lot of times you'll see different forms of the word Baal. You might have a hyphen in there. He's called Balaam, Baal-Berith, Beelzebub, Baal-Peor, and Baalus. There's a few names that are referred to him. The reason why they have the different names for Baal is not because they forgot how to spell it. The reason why they have different names is that he was a regional figure. And each region had their own little twist on Baal. Okay, so in the Old Testament times, gods are regional. You talk about the god of the mountain, can they defeat us in the valley? There's a different god in the valley. So each little area had their own little take on Baal. Archaeologists think they have found evidence of 50 different Baals. I liken Baal to Herod. There's, 26 Herods in the New Testament? I can't keep track of Herod. This is the same way. Each area has their own little Baal. Now, what is Baal? The imagery of Baal. Can we see a picture of Baal? Baal, the imagery is, Baal is in the clouds. When you see clouds, you think of Baal. This is how they thought. Okay, keep going. This is a picture of Baal. They found a lot of different imageries of him. If you see in his hand, this is a thunderbolt. He's up in the clouds. I think I have one more slide. Okay. The imagery is, the clouds are his chariot wheels. I know, this is hard to wrap your mind around. Just think like you're imagining things and you're in the Old Testament times. This is not Baal. I hate to disappoint you. This is an Akkadian version. But it's the same. It's a similar concept I wanted to show to you. They saw the clouds as his chariot wheels, and he rides around. Between the gods, there's some kind of interplay. The gods didn't necessarily like each other. They assumed. And there's the god of death, and he fights with the god of death and Moat, and he goes down to the grave after the rainy season's over. Then the female goddess has to bring him back from the grave, then he can ride the chariots in the clouds and rain, and everything's good. They think he has a relationship with the world, he has a relationship with the earth, and then he spreads his seed, which is the rain, and then the earth flourishes with plants and the crops and whatever else. There's a reason why it's called whoredoms in the Bible so often. It's not really an image you really want to think about too deeply. But this is Baal. He brings the rain. He provides for the people. Okay, I think that's all my slides for now. Unless you just want to look at this one, you can. So, what's wrong? What's wrong with Baal? There's three, I think, really big problems with him. Number one, I think Israel liked Baal because he was a god they could control. I've heard this said, the God of the Bible is just so narrow. I don't really agree with this. I believe in this because it makes me feel more comfortable. God isn't something you can control. You can't follow a set series of rituals and have him do things on command. If they did just the right things, mention the story of Elijah, if they just cut themselves, then he would provide rain. Interesting, this is a side note. Elijah, when he went up into the clouds, he rode up in a chariot, and I think who's watching? Elisha, and I think it was a pointer to him. You know, who rides in the clouds, who rides the chariots? It's me, it's not Baal. So in the future, remember this. You're on the right side, you're on the right team. Anyway, back to my point. People like a God they can control. C.S. Lewis says, God is not a tame lion, meaning you can't just do a series of things and have him perform what you want him to do for you. You can't manipulate God. God is God. He's separate from us. He does what pleases him. So we do the right thing. We do things to please him because he's God. We don't do things to get something out of him. We don't do something to manipulate him. I'll tell you, this mindset creeps in very subtly sometimes. We think you can do things to get God to do something for you. When I was in Bible college, on the day you have a big final exam and you're not so sure about the class, maybe you're on a borderline, an A or B or B or C, or who knows, maybe you just want to pass the class. The day that you have that final exam, what do? You wake up early in the morning, you pray, you read your Bible. Okay? This way you can pass the class. I mean, it sounds like a spiritual thing to do. You know, I'm going to trust God today. But what about all the days? What about the other days of the semester? Did you trust God those days too? I don't know. No, I don't think God could be manipulated. I know people, perhaps they feel guilty they've done something or they said something they shouldn't have, so they're going to put an extra buck in the offering. Here, which if you have extra money to give in the offering, we're all for this. But this by itself does not make God like you more. He wants your whole heart. He doesn't just want a token effort so you can get something out of him. God's ways are above our ways anyway. He cannot be manipulated. We must act in obedience to him and trust him. Trust what he does. You can't control him. You can't manipulate him. But he has a bigger plan in mind than you or I do. So, whatever he does will be best. We can trust in this. Okay. The first reason why Baal worship was so morally wrong, they thought it was a God they can control. Secondly, they had him as insurance. Now, on the one hand, you have Jehovah, this is God. But when things don't work out, it doesn't hurt to have a backup God. So they had both of them. This was an insurance policy. One way or the other, they would be covered. During the Civil War, they've studied some of the houses that were in some of the middle states, and they found in the attics or in the basements, whatever else, sometimes they'll find the two uniforms, the South and the North. And the theory is whichever side's winning, you can put on that uniform and you're covered. Your house will be safe. I think sometimes people spiritually do this. And you've heard this too. I'm not saying you're wrong, but, you know, this is good as well. You should consider this. This denies the fundamental principle of Christianity. No other gods before me. Worshiping God and God alone. I think this is something, maybe we would never say it in these words. You know, I have two or three gods, or, you know, I have 25 gods. But sometimes the way we live our life, it's really the governing ethic in the decisions that we make. Sunday it's going to be this, but you got to make it in the business world. If I don't make that deal, I'm going to miss out. And I may not get that promotion I need. So sometimes we have alternate sets of ethics that we follow. We have to have one God, just like Israel. Sometimes they would have worship God, but they'd also have idols on the side. They'd have both. But this isn't how the worship of God is. The worship of God is focused one way. Okay. This is a couple reasons why the worship of Baal was morally wrong. Let's look at the third reason, and this is where I really unpack my lunch. Number three, the greatest problem with Baal worship was its idolatry. I know this is deep stuff earlier this morning, but it's idolatry. An idol is something that man makes to worship. It's something that they design specifically for what they would like. Isaiah 44 tells us a story. A man goes out in the woods. He chops down a tree, drags the tree back to his house. He chops the tree into three parts. The first part is a fire to warm his house. The second part he puts in the stove to bake some bread. The third party carves up and makes an idol out of it, and he worships it. This is the God that I choose. This is the God of my own making. And the passage goes on to say, the idol will turn to ash in his mouth, meaning he will never be satisfied through this. It will not ultimately satisfy him. I want to tell you, idolatry is not just a piece of wood that people bow down to. Idolatry is something that we have a problem with today in America and in our churches. In the Old Testament, it uses a broader analogy for idolatry. Ezekiel 14:3, Son of man, these men have set up their idols in their heart. It's something that they choose to worship inside. Calvin wrote, he said, our hearts are idol factories. We're constantly manufacturing things to put our trust in and to look to for happiness, things that will take the place of God. In the New Testament, it carries on this motif of idolatry as a spiritual means of worship. Colossians 3:5, mortify therefore you members which are upon the earth, fornication, uncleanness, inordinate affections, evil concupiscence, and covetousness, which is idolatry. So he relates the outward action to a heart that's idolatrous. 1 John 5:21, little children, keep yourself from idols. So what exactly is an idol? I'm going to define it this way. Someone or something that takes the place of God in your life. Something that you would be willing to disobey God to have. I'm going to read this again. This is powerful. Someone or something that takes the place of God in your life and something that you would be willing to disobey God to have. I think we have more idols today than we were in Old Testament times. We're just more sophisticated in hiding them. Let's talk about some idols. What are some idols that we set up in our own lives that we worship? I think about the idol of affirmation. What do other people think about me? Someone grows up in a home that's not a happy place. Their parents are disapproving of them. They can never make their father happy or their mother happy, perhaps. They go through life missing something. They want acceptance and approval. Where do they find this acceptance and approval? Well, you've got your unsafe friends. If you act the way they act, maybe they'll like you. This is an idol. I think of parents today. I think parents are afraid to parent anymore. I think that you can either be the parent that your kid needs, or you can be the parent your kid wants. I think most parents are more worried about being friends than they are parents. And I'll tell you, your kids have plenty of friends already, so you can add yourself to their friend list. But you take a parent that is seeking approval, seeking affirmation. You give them small children. What are they going to do? They're going to do things to make the kid happy. You give them some shiny toy. They get temporary pleasure out of having their kids smile and hug them. This is the affirmation they seek. Now, who loves us and who wants to affirm us? Of course, God does. So the question is, what are we going to see? Where will we seek our affirmation? Are we going to build an idol? Are we going to have our own version of Baal? Or are we going to look to God and His Word and look to God to make us feel affirmed? Okay. Now, if I was a smart person, I'd stop here. But I've got a medal. I'm going to go one step further. Talk about the idol of financial security. You have to have financial security. You have to have that certain number in the bank or in your 401k. When you hit this number, you will feel secure and safe. Of course, the number changes every few years. You go to uncertain times, the number goes up. And then it's not safe in the stock market. You have to have bars of gold hidden in your basement. Well, you have to buy the special safe to put it in because the basement can get robbed. But you have to have all this money. You have to have it diversified. You have to feel safe. Perhaps someone grew up in a home. They didn't have a lot of money. And they always thought, if I want to do better than my dad, I've got to have a little bit more money. I want my kids to not have to worry about money. And we have kids like this that don't worry. They have no concern for anything. And so, in order to fulfill this desire, to fulfill this idol, I'm going to work 7 days a week. I'm going to make this happen. Whether I have time for my family or not, they'll understand when they're older. When I can pay for their college, they'll be happy then. Then I'll explain it to them. This is why I was never home. This person is worshiping idolatry. Perhaps it's a person that's stingy with giving. Okay, I don't have this amount of money piled up high enough yet, so I really can't give to somebody else. I don't feel right giving it over. When I have all this money laid aside, and I have millions of dollars and no worries, which of course never happens, then I'll feel free to put money in the plate. But until then, I'm going to hang on to some of this. So we see this person that has this idolatry. Financial security. I think we have other idols. I'm going to keep beating this horse. This is the idol of pleasure. Our society is all about feelings. This made me feel good. I can't do that. That doesn't make me feel good. I need to find something that makes me feel good. As a father, I'll tell you, there's some days I don't get enough sleep. I'm tired. I go to work, you get hollered out at your boss. You go to church, you get hollered out at church. And after a while, you come home, you don't want to get hollered out again. And it's easy just to tune everything out. You know, I've been responsible enough for one day. I'm going to watch TV and go off into dream world here. I deserve a break. I think I've earned this. Well, I mean, there's a time for unwinding. You can't be constantly on the go. Eventually, you'll break down. You can try, but eventually, you'll break down. But I will tell you, there's an idol that people seek, and that's pleasure. I deserve a good feeling after what I've been through. I deserve this. I should be allowed to do this. It shouldn't matter what I look at or what I listen to. After all, I've worked very hard. Beware of the idol of pleasure. Fulfillment outside of God. God can give you fulfillment. God can give you relaxment. I mean, there's a time for this. There's a time for unwinding. I'm not against this. But when you have to disobey God in order to fulfill this heart desire of yours, I'm going to tell you, you've built yourself an idol. So the question is, how do you fulfill your needs? Baal was a substitute for the true worship of God. Israel had a need for rain. It wasn't just an imaginary need. In order to survive, they had to have rain clouds. They had to have rain. They had an idol, Baal, a man-made idea to meet their needs, a God they could control, a God they can depend on. Where's your dependence? Who takes care of your needs? Who do you look to? Are you willing to disobey God to find it? A few weeks ago, we were in Georgia, Savannah, Georgia. We went off to an island, Tybee Island, and I took my kids. We were with my in-laws, and we went to go see the ocean. And they're playing along on the beach. And the first cousin puts their toes in the water. Then each cousin, there's a bunch of girl cousins. They each have to do it. Eventually, they're getting further and further out in the water. And Brooklyn's cousins are a little older than she is, but she wanted to go too, so I went with her. And she'd stand up against the waves. The wave would come in, and here comes the big wave. It's exciting for a kid, I guess. I got a little excited myself, to be honest. Anyway, the waves come in, you get wet, they go back out, and it's fun. Eventually, she gets more and more confident, and she tells me, she says, "Dad, I don't need you to hold my hand." And she pulls it away. And just as she says this, big wave comes in, washes her under. So I fish her out, pull her up, and she's spitting out water and coughing. After that, she held my hand. I didn't have to tell her again to hold my hand. She got the connection of why you hold Dad's hand. I think sometimes God sends us trials like this. I think we forget to depend on Him. Sometimes we look to other means to take care of ourselves, to protect ourselves. But God is the one who will meet our needs. We must have true worship of God. I think the worship of God can cure our spiritual problems. We have too many Baals. The reason why we have Baals is because we're not worshiping God the way we should. If God is truly the person that you put all your energy into, if God is someone that's worthy of the best that you have, if God is the most important person in your life, a lot of times He'll meet these needs. You won't have to look for other things. Temptations will lose their glamour. When you're really focused on God, the temptation won't seem as strong or as powerful. My question to you is this: how is your worship of God? How are you doing? I think there's levels. I think there's people that open this book and they may look at it for a while. That's one level. There's the studiers. I think that's another level. But I think there's another level even beyond this. I think God is to be worshipped. I think God is to be enjoyed, experienced. Sometimes I think in the morning I just want to wake up and say, "I'm here." And you start your daily walk with Him. You enjoy Him. He's a part of your life. I think this is the greatest part of worship. Experiencing and knowing God. I think this will cure our problem with idolatry. Okay, I'm done. Just like that. Thank you.